My name's Corbin. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 12th of 2008, and my home group is the Hillcrest Group in Springfield, Missouri. We meet at 8 p.m. on Wednesday nights at the Hillcrest Presbyterian Church. So if you're ever in Springfield, Missouri, one, I'm sorry. And two, we'll try and make you feel a little bit better, and come give us a call. We'll show you a good time. One of the things that we pride ourselves in is welcoming people, both people who come there a lot and people that come to visit us. So hope to show you a good home group if you come. Like many people have said before me, this is not my favorite thing to do. I don't know if you can tell, but there's a few beads of sweat, some shaky knees, and probably a shaky voice, but something we were talking about up here just a minute ago is you look out and you see family. You know, and I think that's part of why sometimes it's nervous, because I really do think the world of you, even though a majority of you I've never met, or I've never talked to, and I don't know your name. But the fact that you're in this room with me and you suffer from the same deal that I do means the world to me. That's what sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous, was simply showing up someplace for the first time and feeling a part of instead of apart from, which was a feeling that I still can't put in words, but that I never thought I'd be able to get. A couple things about me. I have never taken a legal drink. I got sober 6 days after my 18th birthday. So I just celebrated 10 years a couple days after celebrating turning 28. So I'd like to think I celebrated managing to not kill myself for 28 years and celebrated actively trying to stay alive for the last 10. And it has been an amazing journey, filled with lots of blessings. And if there are young people out there right now who are not sure if you fit in this program or if this is for you, I am here to tell you absolutely that it can be if you choose to make it. I struggled when I got here. I struggled identifying. I struggled whether or not I was a real alcoholic, whether someone that young could really know that they have a drinking problem. Honestly, it took me about 3 months before I caught alcoholism. You know, I was in these rooms surrounded by you people, listening to what you said, identifying at times. But I remember going out to eat after I picked up my three-month chip. I was with one of my best friends in early sobriety, and we go to this Chinese restaurant, and we sit down, and I get my food. He goes to get his, and he comes back, and I am bawling like a baby in the middle of this Chinese restaurant for almost no reason. And the look on his face, I will never forget, because he was just mortified. He's like, what the heck are you doing? Why are you crying in the middle of this Chinese restaurant? Like, it can't be that bad. Like, we could have gone someplace nicer, but what's the deal? And I sat there crying because I said, I'm 3 months sober. I picked up a three-month chip, and I feel just as lost as I did when I came in here. And I think it's supposed to be different. I'm supposed to feel more confident. I'm supposed to have more clarity. I'm supposed to have it figured out by now, right? 3 months sober. And he asked me a very simple question that was really powerful, and he said, well, do you remember your last drink? And I did, and he asked me to describe it to him, and I'll hopefully mention that later. But when I got done telling that story, I can't tell you what was different, I can't tell you why, but for the first time I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And everything was different from that point on. And I'm always going to be grateful for that moment. And I may not remember the first time that I got drunk, I remember the first time I drank, but I definitely remember the last time I drank. And if I ever have questions, that's all I have to go back to. So a little bit about me. I grew up in a very loving home. I can't say that I really wanted for anything. I was always taken care of. I had amazing parents. Things did get a little bit darker along the way. I'd say when I maybe got about halfway through grade school, my mom started having some struggles. There was a lot of verbal abuse, but never anything physical. But it definitely impacted me. And I'd say that it did not make me an alcoholic. It did not contribute to my alcoholism, but it made the list of excuses to justify my alcoholism. The fact that what happened at home, and I filed that away unknowingly and would come back to that file repeatedly for many years before I finally met you people. But for the most part, was very happy, very loved, played sports, did great in school. But I will say, much like every other person who usually comes up here, my entire life I felt wind blowing through this giant hole in the center of my chest that I could never fill. It didn't matter who I was with. It didn't matter who I was around, what I believed in, how I identified myself, how I dressed myself up. I tried everything from the youngest age I can remember, and that hole was always there. And it drove most of the decisions I made my entire life, that hole that I just could not fill. And I remember from the earliest age, one of the first things I tried was being a comedian. So I was always the kid getting in trouble, pulling pranks at school, getting sent home, getting suspended. And I remember the power that that gave me when I felt like I had an identity. You know, because I didn't have one of those. I didn't know what an identity was. But when I could be Corbin, the kid who was always in trouble, always making jokes, always in the principal's office, there was something that followed the word Corbin. And I wanted anything to follow that word, Corbin. Because in my mind, there's never been anything that's followed my name. Definitely not people or meaningful relationships, to say the least. And luckily, I found a new outlet as a kid, which was sports, which I was a huge athlete. I'm literally now huge, but not an athlete, so things have changed over time. But I absolutely love sports, and the sense of camaraderie that I got out of that was amazing. I mean, that fit in that hole for a while. But if you have the same hole I do, the thing that makes it tricky is it constantly changes shape, and it changes depth. And anything that fits in it now usually doesn't fit in it tomorrow, or 10 minutes from now, or a year from now. The time may change, but inevitably, that hole remains empty again, and I keep searching for something to fill it. And so I love sports, and I used that for that purpose for a long time. Made great friendships, made a lot of cool bonds with people, but ultimately, it always fell to the wayside, because it was never enough. You know, I always did well in school, get to junior high, and I won a DARE essay contest for how I was never going to do drugs, smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol before I was 21. I mean, I had it all figured out. And if I would have had a follow-up to that essay a couple years later, that would have been a very different story. But I say that because I had information. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about alcoholism until I got sober. No information whatsoever. What I have learned is fear and bad things that happen to people who drink, people who do drugs, people who smoke cigarettes. I heard all this information my whole life and chose to accept it as true, but didn't have any true experience with it or any type of knowledge that held depth and weight. So you get me into high school. The worst thing that can happen to an alcoholic in the making is to put me in high school as a teenager, because I'm already restless, irritable, and discontent, and then you add in hormones and girls and a bunch of other guys who are way better than me, and it's just a giant mess. And so I walked around terrified. I mean, terrified every minute of my life. Terrified that you were better than me, and terrified that you didn't know I was better than you. Right? That age-old paradox that we all talk about, nothing unique. But it was terrifying. I was scared every moment. And I did what we all do. I tried to build myself up. I tried to be tough. I tried to play sports. But they were all just masks to hide the fear that I carried around with me every day. And fast forward, when I get into high school, it might have been right when I got to high school or shortly before, but I ended up in a very interesting place for my first drink. And my first drink, I did not take willingly. I was at and I swear I'm not making this up, I was at a Valentine's dance at a Latin nightclub in Springfield, Missouri. So I'll give you a couple minutes to just really soak in those three things in a row. And my role at dances was very important. My job was to sit at the table with other people who were not going to go up there and dance with other people and talk about how we were better than all those people who were out there dancing and having a good time. And if only they took a minute to come sit with us, they could really realize what they were supposed to be doing instead of being up there being better than us. And I'm sitting there, and I was talking to a buddy. Attention wasn't on the table. And one of our friends had come, and he had snuck in a bottle of rum. And he went around that table, and he had just put a little bit in everybody's drink. And I turned around, continuing to preach about the air of the waves of the people up there dancing and smiling and doing all of those things that I could never do and never knew why. And I start drinking this Coke, and slowly but surely, I get a little bit of confidence, start feeling warm. This feeling goes all throughout my body and, most importantly, my mind. And for the first time, I realized that I had this audio playing in my head because it stopped. I never knew that there was insanity screaming between my ears my entire life because I'd never known anything different. It's hard to know there's an issue until you see something else. You know, if you ask a fish, how's the water? The fish is going to say, what's water? You don't know until you land in something else. And the first time I took a drink and it settled in, I found that something else. And unknowingly, I stood up, walked over to the dance floor, started talking to girls, started dancing around, started smiling, laughing. Couldn't understand why the rest of those people at that table looked so upset. I mean, I don't know what their problem was, but man, they were not having it. But I felt amazing. And that was something that filled that hole in a different way that nothing else ever had. And I would pour booze in that hole because no matter what shape it took or how deep it went, if I just poured enough, surely that hole would be full. And I didn't just go off to the races. I didn't start drinking like a maniac. But I learned an important lesson that day, or I should say I thought I learned an important lesson that day, which was that all information I had about alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, whatever it might be, was false. Because none of the things that they told me would happen happened. Instead, I found a level of serenity that I had never known in my entire life. So this seemed to be the best thing that had ever happened to me. Definitely not the worst thing or the most dangerous thing. And so even though I didn't go off to the races, that was a huge moment for me. Because that day, I let down the wall I had built up that kept me away from alcohol and anything else that would change my state of mind. And slowly but surely, I started drinking a little bit more, started going to some parties. I continued to play sports in high school, so I tried to get in with the jocks. You know, they had the whole social pyramid that's been there since the beginning of time, and my goal every day was to change how I talked, how I looked, what I liked, to slowly work my way to the top. Because as long as something followed the word Corbin, it was worth it. But what nobody told me is that once you got to the top of that pyramid, it goes back down. And you will reach the bottom in half the time it took you to reach the top. And that's absolutely what happened at the end of my drinking. Is everything that I thought that I wanted disappeared almost as soon as I felt like I got there. But it all just started with a couple drinks here and there, a couple parties, you know, and then life happened to me in a big way when I was young, when I was a teenager in high school. Several things happened in quick succession that just, they added to my list of reasons why I needed more and more alcohol to fill that hole deeper and deeper. You know, one of the first things I remember is that I got a brain virus called encephalitis, which for those of you who are aware of it or familiar with it, it's usually deadly. I mean, it's not a good deal. It's in your brain. And I had no idea what was wrong with me. I had no idea what was going on, but I was being moved from hospital to hospital. I think in total, I was in the hospital for 3 or 4 months. I don't remember a majority of it. A lot of it has been blocked out. I've had some flashbacks over the years, but obviously there's a lot of trauma in that for me. And I'd grown up in Catholic schools. Had never had a problem with God. To be fair, I never really tried to create a relationship, right? For whatever reason, it just never occurred to me. I'd go to church, I'd do what you made me do, but I never saw a deeper relationship there. I didn't know it was possible. But put me in a hospital for 3 months, in more pain than I ever knew, with more fear than I'd ever had, thinking that this might be my last shot on this earth. I may not have had any positive relationships with God, but I very quickly built a negative relationship. Because I thought, I may not feel like I have anything, but what would I want from a creator that would do this to me at such a young age? Right? Right on the list. Big reason number two to drink and to forget about it. And I also thought that if any day on this earth could be my last, why would I not want to put as much of that stuff in me as possible every day that makes me feel in a way I've never felt before? What's there to lose? It could disappear at any moment. Shortly after that, I had to relearn how to walk. I had to build my muscles back up. Got back to normal. And my grandmother, who was a second mother to me. I mean, I loved my grandma more than anybody in this world. And I think about her a lot today, which is why it's hard not to get emotional. Not from back then, but I think about her so much because she was such a beautiful woman. And she always treated me with nothing but love and kindness. You know, she was the embodiment of the St. Francis prayer. You know, that's the best way I could describe my grandma. And she meant the world to me, and just like everybody else in my life, when I started drinking and started hitting the town, she moved back. Right? Less relationship, less contact, but I still loved her to death. I would have said a bad thing about her, and if she would have came to find me, I would have happily spent time with her. I just loved her. And she got diagnosed with dementia. And slowly but surely, my grandmother became a prisoner in her own head. You know, she knew what she wanted to say. She knew who I was, but her body was forgetting. You know, she couldn't talk. She couldn't move. And I am watching the most perfect person in this world enter a hell that I would not wish on my worst enemy. And again, I go back to this creator that I've been learning about my entire life and thought, why? Why would something like this ever happen to a person like her? Now, a normal person probably sees that scenario and they go, now it's time to step up. It's time to go be with my grandma. It's time to help her, to enjoy the times I still have with her, and to do anything I can to help her out as we go through this process. But you already have probably guessed that I'm not a normal person. So what do? I realize that hole just got a couple feet deeper, and so I start pouring a little bit more. And I start putting more distance. The farther away I can get from the pain and the more booze that I can put in the hole, the better I'll feel. And so I pretty much lost all contact. Did not try, did not return phone calls, did not make visits. I ran. And I ran and I ran as far as I could. And it was just like this demon on my shoulder that I couldn't escape. And that hit me hard. And right about that time, I also ended up having to have back surgery because I was a football player. I was always a big soccer player, but my high school didn't have a football team. Didn't have a soccer team because they were really well known for football. And when my generation showed up, we changed that. We totally ruined the entire football program. But that was me, right? I had to have Corbin the football player, Corbin the jock. And I went in there and I damaged my back. And I was a lineman because Springfield's a very small town. So at like 5'9 and 150 pounds, I was one of the biggest kids in my class. So they threw me on the offensive line. And that's really not that big. So very quickly, I paid the price when I tried to go against real size linemen. And that's how I hurt my back. But being a part of football culture, what I didn't hear was, you're a young guy. You should probably get checked out. You should take it easy. You got your whole life ahead of you. What I heard was, quit being a girl. Suck it up. The team needs you. Let's go do this. And the power of that camaraderie had been something I held on to the whole time. So, of course, push through it, fight through it, ended up doing a lot of irreversible damage. So I ended up having to do back surgery, which also led to spinal fusion later on. And now I couldn't play sports. Right, the one semi-healthy outlet that I had for all that stuff in my head, just to feel a part of, just to feel like something came after the word Corbin, was taken away. And so all that did was create a very big empty space to be filled by alcohol. I still knew the people. I still had the thing next to my name. I still had the invites to the parties. So I got drunk as often as possible. Granted, I'm in high school, so I know that that may not be an impressive amount of time compared to what it could have been if we fast-forwarded to a legal drinking age. But in my life, that was a lot. You know, if I could drink every day or if I could get drunk every weekend, I did. And slowly I crossed that line to where I started creating my own opportunities and I didn't rely on other people anymore. You know, one of the things I looked back on to think, was I an alcoholic compared to everyone else in high school who did the same thing, was people would hide bottles because they didn't want to get caught by their parents. Right? That was their motivation for hiding their alcohol in their house. My motivation for hiding alcohol in my room was so that when I got caught drinking, I still had booze to drink while I was locked in my room. Right? It was a strategic decision, not a necessary decision. My concern was not on getting caught. It was making sure it was available when that inevitably happened. Right? So as I start lining this out, that's when drinking's starting to take control. And I don't know. Right? I don't see it. I don't see the claws of alcoholism gripping me tighter and tighter. All I know is I'm continuing to use the only solution I've ever had to that audio in my head that will never be quiet. And so I'm doing it, and I'm doing it, and I'm hitting it hard, and I'm hitting it hard, and all of a sudden, all the people in my life start to change too. And I remember friends I had had my entire life, again, I know, not that long, but they come up to me and go, what's wrong with you? Why are you doing this? Why are you this person? What's wrong with the life you have? You're so selfish. I remember that's the first time I ever remember being accused of being selfish. The times in these rooms far outweigh those times before, but that was the first time that I ever remember being told that I was selfish. And I remember thinking, how selfish are you? You don't know what goes on in here. You don't know what goes on in here. And you don't see this giant hole that I am desperately trying to fill just so I don't want to kill myself on a daily basis. And if you knew what this did for me, how dare you? How dare you not want me to have the only thing that has ever fixed that problem. You're selfish. And I happily moved all of those people out of my life. You didn't like it? Fine. There are always people a little bit less sick or more sick than me who would take those spots. And I just surrounded myself with people who drank and did what I did. But slowly but surely, those people started to disappear too. People that I never thought I could have ever have offended wanted nothing to do with me. You know, the people, we always have that one person who's worse than us, right? The one person that gives us the motivation to keep going, because as soon as I'm like that guy, I'll stop. You know, in 1 minute you turn around and realize you've been that person for everybody else. You know, and that's what happened for me. And so I get through all this stuff. Things at home get worse and worse, as you can imagine. Already having kind of a hectic home with some craziness going on, throwing alcohol in the mix for me did not help. And I also had a forum for practicing manipulation. You know, I would pin my parents against each other as much as possible, because if they were busy fighting with each other, that meant I had the opportunity to leave and go get drunk. Right? So I pinned them against each other every opportunity I could. And I remember one night, my mom, who is sick, just like us, her sickness had caused an event. And then I remember highlighting that event to my dad, because I was getting called out about being drunk. So, of course, I switched the conversation over to what she had been doing. They started screaming at each other. I snuck out the door, like I always did, to go get to my car to go drink. And my dad comes running down the stairs. And he says, "Hey, let's go get a movie. We'll go down to Blockbuster." For those of you who are somehow younger than me, a Blockbuster was like a DVD or a Blu-ray, but on a giant cassette tape. And we went to the Blockbuster. It was about 9 o'clock at night, so already I'm like, this is an interesting time to go find a movie, considering the current state of events taking place in the house. And I get in the car, we're driving over there, and my dad looks at me and he goes, "What would you think if I divorced your mom?" Right? I had pitted these people against each other so much, caused so much trauma in their lives, so much distrust, just so much crap, right? I'm sure it wasn't the only source, but it was a huge factor. And it got to a point where he was entertaining the idea of divorcing my mom. And one thought stuck with me. I had a fleeting thought, but one thought that really stuck with me as soon as he said that. The fleeting thought was, look what you've done. Look at where you have taken your parents. Look at the impact you're having on their lives. Shame on you. Fleeting. The second thought that brought calm, that brought comfort, that allowed me to go, was, it is going to be so much easier to drink now. I'll have two homes, two parents trying to outdo the other. What more could an alcoholic teenager ask for? That was the thought that gave me comfort the rest of that car ride. And shortly after that, obviously that situation did not turn out the best. They didn't get divorced, but it was pretty rocky for a while. I had to live somewhere else with a close friend. Had some crazy phone calls from my mom going back and forth, because although what she was saying may not have been the right thing to do, there was a lot of truth in it as far as the impact I'd had on their relationship, and she was letting me know it very clearly. And again, thanks. More time to go drink. More excuses, more motivation, more reason to keep pouring into the hole. I keep going, get all the way to where I'm about 18. And I remember on my 18th birthday, I didn't have a single friend in the world that wanted to spend any time with me. You know, my favorite thing to do was get a 30-pack of Keystone, because it was the cheapest. And when you're not 21 and you usually got to pay somebody else to get your booze, cheap is the best option. It's also how I learned that Price Cutter, one of the local grocery stores in Springfield, always stocked the Black Label Scotch behind the Lay's potato chips, because that was the backup plan if I couldn't find somebody to pay for my booze. So I'm sitting in my car. It's my 18th birthday. God only knows where I told my parents I was. It was not strange for me to disappear off at random points in time and to come back with some ridiculous excuse, but I was out doing what I do, calling everybody on my phone. Anyone who answered had not a good thing to say to me. Right? Most people didn't. So I'm sitting in my car in this parking lot at this park where we played disc golf. That was my stomping grounds for majority of my drinking. And I opened up this 30-pack of Keystone. And as I start drinking each one of these Keystones, I start feeling more fear than I have ever felt in my entire life. I mean, to this day, I have never been more scared than I felt that night sitting in that car alone. Because eventually I grabbed for a beer, and they were all gone. And I had 30 empty beer cans laying all around me in this car. And that yelling in my head was still there. And I was terrified. I have never been more scared in my life than when the only thing that ever made it go away stopped working. Right? But when you have an antidote to a poison that you've taken your entire life, and that antidote stops working, you don't put it down. You just desperately keep trying over and over and over again, praying that it's going to do what it used to, because what other option is there? And that's what I did. I wish I could say that that was a moment where I realized that I just got to stop. It doesn't work anymore. Instead, I was just more scared than I'd ever been, and I drank harder than I ever could, started mixing things that I never thought I would mix together, desperately trying to shut up that voice in my head that was screaming at me every hour of the day. I remember driving home. I remember trying to kill myself. I couldn't get myself to do it directly. So what I would do is I would take the curvy road home, and I would close my eyes. And I would just drive. And I would just keep them closed as long as I could. And I would remember opening my eyes still on the road and hating myself. Just hating that I couldn't have kept them closed for a minute longer. Just a little bit closer to that curve where I could have gone off the road. But I never could. I could never do it. You know, go forward a couple days. I'm getting towards my last drink. I go out to my stomping grounds like I usually do. Nobody wants anything to do with me. But luckily, this one guy who I had drank with from time to time, he'd just gotten out of rehab. I didn't know that until I met him in sobriety, and he told me. And I was like, oh, fantastic. I'm glad I brought you back in style. And he comes up to my car window, and I'd just taken a whole handful of outside issues. And he comes up and goes, hey, how's it going? And I'm like, good. How are you doing? This is weird. You don't understand. No one's done this for a while, so I'm kind of taken aback, and I have no idea what to say. I said, oh, I'm good. How are you? And he goes, well, I'm just sitting up here waiting for my buddies to join me to get some drinks. You want to come over and have a shot with me? And I sat there, and I went, it's probably not a good idea. I've got a bunch of other stuff in here right now. I know I'm not going to feel the way I want to feel, and I know that I'm going to black out, I'm going to do a bunch of stuff, and I'm not going to know what it is, right? Like, this is where the sequel to the movie going on in my life is going to come out, and I'm not going to see it. But then I go, one shot? Sure, let's go do one shot. It's like the magic words for every drunk, I feel like, is that we've got the knowledge, we've got the experience, but as soon as I hear just one, what could go wrong? So I get out of the car, I walk over, I sit down with this guy. I remember the spot. I'll never forget it. On this bench, right in front of this tree. I know that's super descriptive. It's probably hard to imagine that. And he pours that shot. I throw that shot back. And again, I see the light start to flash. That means that sequel is about to start playing. Right? I feel it. I know that I am right on that verge of losing my mind, and that I'm going to come to at some point having no idea what's happened. And he starts filling up that shot glass again. And I remember looking at that shot glass, and in that shot glass I saw all the pain, all the misery, all the trouble, all the grief that was going to come out of taking that drink in that shot glass. And I can tell you, armed with all the self-knowledge in the world of what could happen, what would happen, and the fact that it would not do what I needed it to, all of that in my head, every bit of willingness to not want to take that drink, every bit of willpower, and I watched my hand pick up that shot glass, and I watched it come up to my mouth. I felt it go down my throat, and I was gone. And what happened after that was told to me, because obviously I don't remember, fleeting memories coming in and out, but nothing that puts a storyline together. And I'd like to say, thank God, I did not hurt anybody or do unreversible damage. But it was a blackout. I don't know what happened. I don't know if something horrible or miserable might have taken place for somebody else because of the result of my actions. And part of me, honestly, is grateful for that. Because if I remembered some of the things that happened in my blackouts, I don't know if I would have continued to not want to kill myself, to not actually go through with it. But I remember being told the story later that I blacked out, stole the bottle, that's assumed, ran off into the woods, finished the bottle by myself, walked back up into the parking lot where everybody had showed up to by then, and I was just in and out, face down into the asphalt, blood all over me, asphalt sticking in my face, slurring all over the place, falling into cars, trying to fight people. Before I can swing, they've already knocked me in the face, and I'm sure I was already unconscious before the hit ever landed. But I am just a beaten up ragdoll. And everybody was laughing. Everybody was pointing at me, laughing. Never seen anybody that messed up in their entire life. And these people may not have been good friends, but they were at least decent enough humans to care when I managed to crawl my way to my car and drive off. Because they jumped in their cars and they chased me. And I proceeded to drive home on the wrong side of the major roads in Springfield. Disclaimer, major roads in Springfield are probably back roads in any other city in America, but there are big roads. Driving through people's yards, taking down mailboxes, running people off the road, and who knows why, but for some reason I finally stopped at a stoplight. Not that that had influenced my decisions up to that point in the night, but I just decided to stop for some reason. And they came in, they pinned my car with their cars, they knocked me out, ripped me out of that driver's seat, threw me in the passenger seat, and they drove me home. And they left me in my parents' driveway in a puddle of my own vomit, my own urine, and my own blood. Right? And that's how my parents came out to find their son. And so they grabbed me, they dragged me in there, and I remember my little brother was sitting on the couch. It's one of the few memories I have of that night. And my poor brother, I am so proud of him to this day. He's a Marine in the reserves, has done amazing things with his life. He grew up obviously in the same house I did, but had even less good years than I did before a lot of the craziness started to happen. But I never helped him with that. I was never a good example. I never went out of my way to try and help him out or think about how he was feeling. He was an obstacle. Because a little brother, I'm supposed to set an example for. And if I'm setting an example, I'm not supposed to be drinking. And therefore, you are an enemy, you are an obstacle, and I'm going to treat you like that so that I can get you as far away from me as possible. And that's how I treated my poor little brother. 13 years old, only stable person in his life is his dad. Our dad's losing his mind because he's surrounded by a bunch of sick people. But he looked at me, watched them drag me through that house, screaming, cussing, bleeding, pouring out of everywhere. They dragged me up the stairs, threw me down on my mattress. And I remember the tears. I remember the tears from my dad, who had always been my hero, but my actions never showed it. And that was another thing that would drive me crazy, was the vast amount of respect and love for my dad, but the seeming impossible ability to show that to him through my actions. I hated myself for it. But I remember him standing over me, and I remember the tears falling down and hitting me like bullets. And I remember he asked, "What did we do wrong? What have we done? What mistakes did we make? Why are you like this?" And I grabbed my dad, and I pulled him down, and I said, "I don't know. Kill me." Because I've been asking myself that longer than I can remember, and I'm not finding any answers. And I blacked out, woke up the next morning, bloodied, smell like pee, smell like blood, the usual. So no reason to think anything monumental happened the night before. My dad came in to wake me up. I yelled, said nasty things at him like I usually did when he woke me up after I made it back home drunk. And my dad cried again. It's only the second time in my life I'd seen him cry. The first time was that night. And he said, "You don't even remember, do you?" And I didn't. And then my dad told me everything that happened that previous night. You know, and I tried so hard to reach the top of that social pyramid in school, right? Drink with the right people, do other stuff with the right people, play the right sports with the right people, just make a name for yourself and be something. Put something after Corbin. And I remember walking through the halls of the school that day, and the only resemblance I had was to Moses. Because, man, those halls just parted. As soon as I turned a corner, everybody just moved away. And that's about as the loneliness that I can remember. I can't ever remember feeling more lonely than seeing the only people around me making such an effort to get away from me. And I went home that night, and my mom had told me, "We found this place, it's called the Florida Center for Recovery, and we think you should go." right? My parents just opened up the phone book, looked for anything, called the first number they found, and it led to a recovery center in Florida, Fort Pierce, Florida. And they asked me about it. It was a voluntary treatment center, so they didn't force me. But I'm sitting here going, well, everybody hates me. I'm drinking and it's not working, and it's going to be a hell of a lot harder to drink now. And it's Florida. I'm in Springfield, Missouri. Florida's pretty appealing every day of the year. So I'm like, what's the worst that can happen, taking a 30-day break from school, getting to hang out in Florida? Looked at the website. They had a pool, all these beautiful things. It was great. So I thought, sure, why the hell not? Now, I say that, but the likelihood of me following up on decisions I make at this point in my life are slim to none. So even though I've accepted it might be cool to spend 30 days in Florida, that is no indication that that's actually going to happen. But I didn't end up going. And what had happened was my parents had called that place, and they have people paid and working for that recovery center whose one job is to get credit card numbers, get people on flights, and get their bodies there, right? And to remind us to be messed up when we got there to make sure our insurance would cover it, right? Best motives out there for anybody. So I get on the phone with this lady who, again, her job is to get a credit card number, get my details, get me on a plane, make sure I got insurance so that this recovery center can get paid. And help me get sober or something. So I'm talking to her, and she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know this at the time. I learned this later because I called her back after I left that treatment center. But I talked to her, and for the first time in my life, somebody talked to me, and they told me how I thought, how I acted, how I felt, everything I had done, everything I was planning on doing. And I cannot tell you how much depth and weight that held for me. You know, it talks about that in the doctor's opinion, how frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. I have had plenty of frothy, especially frothy emotional appeal in my life. From me, from family, from friends, from clergy. Dunk me, dip me, spray me, whatever you want to do. It never worked. But I got on the phone with this lady. And I got to talk unknowingly to another alcoholic who had the same deal that I did. And for the first time in my life, I felt like somebody knew who I was. A brief glimpse past the audio in my head without a drink. And because of that lady and because of the message that she carried to me on that one phone call, I decided for sure I am going to commit to going to this treatment center. I made sure to tell my parents so that it actually happened, but I did. I decided, yes, I want to go. What's the worst that could happen? So I show up. They ask me if I messed up. I say no. I've got eyes the size of headlights, and I can barely talk, so they figured it out for themselves. And I remember I was in the detox wing for several weeks. I mean, I'd come in rough, and of course, the first thing I did before I left was I snuck out to my car to pack my things for the trip, and I just consumed every last thing that I had because I knew it was going to go to waste. Because what better way to get sober than to get really unsober? So I put all that in me, show up. God knows what I looked like. They told me, but I still would have a hard time picturing it. And I'm in this detox wing, and the most interesting people you'll ever see in your life will show up in a detox wing, and especially when they're shared rooms. So every night I got to see a new, interesting individual who was also detoxing, many far more worse than I was. Far older than I was, far scarier than I was. So it was kind of like a little horror show was just playing the first couple days in my life while I was in treatment. But I remember finally snapping out of it, right? Like the first day of clarity. I didn't even realize until I celebrated my anniversary this year. Believe it or not, Facebook brought clarity, which I never would have guessed. But my sobriety date has always been October 12th, because that's the first day I can remember being sober. I don't know if any of you have that experience out there, but asking me for a sobriety date was like asking for $1 million. You got to be sober to know what the hell your sobriety date was. And I was just like, well, the first day I think I remember being sober was October 12th. Well, it turns out October 10th is when I went to that treatment center. So I'm imagining October 11th was actually the first day I didn't put anything in my body. But it was several days until I really snapped out of it enough to be aware of my surroundings. You know, I had that message of depth and weight that pulled me there, and after about a couple days and coming to, I realized I'd made a horrible mistake, right? Because depth and weight only goes so far without action and willingness. But I was like, oh man, I've made a huge mistake. Look at all these people. I was by far the youngest person there by a lot. Did not relate with anybody. The only thing I loved about that place was I said, yeah, I smoke. I guess I'll stop doing that too while I'm here. And they went, uh-uh. They said, we'll buy your first carton, pay us back later. So my parents, God love them, they were sending me money every week just so I could get cigarettes, even though they hated that I smoked. And I would just sit out there smoking cigarettes. And I remember sitting on this bench, one of my first few visits outside of the detox wing. And I look over, and there's about a 6'6", probably maybe around 200 pounds. He wasn't huge, but he was a big guy. African-American man with one eye. The other side of his face just had a line down it, big old white ball. He lost it in a bar fight with a broken beer bottle. But he sees me, I see him, and he starts walking towards me. And in no situation in my head does that work out well for me, right? Keep in mind, I'm an 18-year-old boy from Springfield, Missouri, probably about one of the least cultured places in the country. I have no idea what's supposed to happen, but it can't be good. So I am just shaking, just, oh my God, my last cigarette, better enjoy it. He walks up to me, he stands me up, and he gives me a hug. And I still crap my pants, because that scared me more than anything else he could have done. But his name was Jarvis. And Jarvis gave me a big hug. And Jarvis said, you may have forgotten about God, but God hasn't forgotten about you. And again, I wish some spiritual seed exploded out of that hole in my chest. And all of a sudden I was enlightened by the spirit of the universe and jumped right into recovery and everything was great. That's not what happened. But a seed nonetheless was planted, right? And now I'm sitting in these meetings and I'm listening to these people talk. And for the first time in my life, I'm looking around at people who get me. That is what sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous. No one was within a 10-year age range of me out of the 50 people who were here. But every day I ate, I slept, I did dishes, I washed my clothes, I smoked cigarettes with all of these people. And every last person I talked to got me. And I felt understood. And for the first time in my life, without booze, that audio started to tune down. Just being in proximity to you people. And I will never be able to describe that feeling in words, but it is the best feeling I've ever had in my entire life. That's more than kids, that's more than relationships. That moment I will never forget. To finally feel a part of. To feel like there was something after Corbin that didn't have to go anywhere. And by God, if I ever would have guessed that the thing to follow Corbin was, I'm an alcoholic. But that's what it was. That's what I needed my entire life was, I'm an alcoholic. That's what I was missing. And the moment I found it, my life was changed. It doesn't mean I was perfect. It doesn't mean that I did everything I was supposed to. But it was fundamentally different from that moment on. Because I had a healthy mix of desperation and a healthy mix of a somewhat solution in what it looked like. So I'm in this recovery center, doing great. I catch fire. I'm doing all these step work packets. You know, everyone loves step work packets, right? Like it's every sponsor's dream. Show up from treatment and go, well, here's the work I've done so far. Man, I love those things. And the only thing I love more than those things is that when we started the same stuff over again every 2 weeks because new people were always coming in here, I just kept the old ones and figured out how to spice them up a little bit every time I had to turn them back in. And I was like, man, I'm good at this stuff. But slowly, I see a solution. I start feeling better. I've got all these great things happening that I've never felt in my life. And it hits me. You're 18 years old. You're supposed to be at school right now. And you're halfway across the country. We got to get out of here. Thanks for the information. I'm good to go. I now know that I'm sick. I'm not calling myself an alcoholic yet. People keep giving me really cute things to call myself, and I'm trying them all out on different nights. But I've got it. We'll go figure this out. So I remember being elected the president of that very high-class facility for a week, which turned out to be an amazing tactic to utilize alcoholic egos to keep us out of their hair, and it worked perfectly. I mean, all they had to say was, youngest president in FCR history. And somehow I found a suit, and I had a list, and I was ready to teach people how to be in that rehab and to solve all their issues. I'd like to say that I had a lot of really good campaigning things. I was able to switch from romaine lettuce to a mix of lettuce for our lunch salads. It's about the only impact I made during my presidency at that facility. But ironically, oh, and by the way, don't think for a minute I didn't call my parents, tell them how I was elected president of this facility, and then was horribly hurt when they did not weep joys of pride at their 18-year-old son being president of the rehab. But I forgave them. I forgave them. But conveniently, right after I lose that badge of importance that I was so happy to get, I decided it was time to go. I've seen all of it. I've done all of it. I got what I need. And I walked into that director's office like I did every day when I was president, and I said, "Listen, Tammy, I can't thank you enough for what you've given me. I can't thank you enough for what you taught me. But I'm 18 years old. I got school to do, relationships to fix, better life to live. I'm out." And she did the most powerful and important thing she could have ever done in that moment. She said, "Go to your room." And I stood up, immediately lost all respect for that woman, but still went to my room. And I sat there and I started plotting how I was going to get out of that place. And all the beautiful things I said about this place to my parents on the phones turned into mold in the air conditioners and violent nurses and refusing to give people their medication. And oh my God, I'm not going to live to stay sober if you don't yank me out of this place. They were smart enough to take that with a grain of salt, but they still came down about a week later because it was family weekend. Keep in mind, we're in Springfield, Missouri. So my entire family pays the money to fly down to come see me for a day in Florida. These people that I've given no reason to do that for or make that kind of investment. And I remember sitting there smoking my cigarettes because it was still important I showed them I was smoking even though they didn't like it. And I remember sitting there, and my mom being the mom she was, we may have had a lot of issues, but she was still my mom. I was still her baby, and she had a plane ticket. She said, "It's yours if you want it." And thanks to you people, the small amount of recovery I mustered in that place, for the first time in my life, I had a selfless thought. And I turned to my dad, and also for the first time in my life, my actions showed him the respect and love I had for him. And I said, "Dad, what do you think I should do?" And he cried, and he looked me in the eyes, and he said, "It's been a long time since you've finished anything. And I think this would be a really good place to start." And I said, "Okay, but I need you to leave. Because the longer I look at you, I'm going to want to come home." And I asked them to leave. They'd been there 2 hours, flew all the way down, and they said, "Okay." And them and my little brother walked off. And I cried and I cried and I cried the rest of that day. But the people in that place with me picked me up, just like you do to this day. They comforted me, they loved me, they got me back on my feet the next day, and I caught fire again and did every last thing they asked me to in that treatment center, and was terrified the day I had to leave. But my parents, God bless them, they already reached out, they had a meeting pamphlet waiting for me when I got home, and I got to have my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I get home, I look at this meeting pamphlet, it's a Wednesday. I don't know my home group exists yet, but there was a group called the Battlefield Group, the Methodist Church. And keep in mind, I have not learned that we're basement people at this point in time. Okay? All I know about Alcoholics Anonymous is what I saw in that treatment center, which is once a week, this guy comes in, tells the same horrible jokes about people who don't drink, and then says, "What questions do you have about AA?" Like, I'm going to know what to ask based off that interaction repeatedly every Wednesday. So I show up, and there's only two things I knew about AA. There's a circle. Everybody's got books. That's all I got. So I walk into this church, and there's a circle. And they all have books. And so I sat down. And they're talking, and they're hooting, and they're hollering, and they're having a hell of a time. And I'm like, "All right, this is pretty cool. Everyone's happy. Looks like I'm going to have fun here." And I'm not really listening to what they're saying, to be fair. I didn't listen to much of anything anyone was saying when I first got sober. But all I know is at one point, I heard the guy leading the session go, "Does anybody have any questions?" So I raised my hand and I said, "Yes, I have a question. Am I in the right place?" And he went, "You're in the right place. We love you." And I went, "Great. Well, my name's Corbin and I'm an alcoholic." And he went, "Downstairs." And that's the extent of my experiences with Baptist Bible studies. Now, nothing short of divine intervention then leads to me actually going downstairs to find the meeting, right? What better excuse do you need to just leave at that point and go do anything else? But I walked down those stairs, but I learned an important lesson out of that interaction, and that was that I was sitting in the back, and I was not saying a word to anybody. So I sat in the back, and I didn't say a word to anybody, but thank God, the power of cigarettes, they had a smoking meeting. Who could refuse a smoking meeting? I went outside, sat with those people. The topic was the first step. I have no idea I'm the reason the topic is the first step. So I share my infinite wisdom on the first step from the many first step packets I worked in treatment. Thank God those people were there to walk away with a little sobriety. And I remember meeting was over. Of course, I was ready to go, started walking away. One man took the time to walk up to a young, dumb drunk and say, "I'm so happy you're here, and I hope you come back." I don't know how you felt the first time you heard that in sobriety, but that meant the world to me. I just sat there, baffled, teary-eyed, feeling loved for the first time since I'd left that treatment center, right? But it was different. I lived with those people every day. I wasn't ever leaving until it was time to go. This guy never had to see me again, and he wanted me to come back, and he was happy that I was there. One guy. And it turns out that that guy had 30 years sober at that time. And I mention that because that's how you get 30 years sober, is being that one guy who walks up to the young, dumb drunk who thinks he just taught you about the first step. And you tell him, "I love you. I'm glad you're here. And I hope you come back." And he did me another favor, and he told me there was another meeting the next night that had some young people at it and I should go. And I did, and that meeting became my home group for the first 18 months of my sobriety. Every last person, when I showed up to that group, shook my hand, told me they were happy I was there, and that's how I knew I was home. You know, and you fast forward a little while into being at that home group, and one night, the reason I'm standing here in front of you today is not because of people with 20, 30, 40 years of sobriety, but because of three young men that all had less than a year. Now, behind all three of those young men with less than a year was an old timer. But these three young men were practicing a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they saw me sitting in that crowd. And before that meeting had started, they formed a game plan, and each one of them went for a door to make sure that I did not get out of that meeting without talking to one of them. Because I had already skillfully learned how to dodge spending time with you after these meetings. I was 18 years old. I had homework. I had responsibilities at home. I had a curfew. None of these things were remotely true, but I had all the excuses in the world. But they knew what they were doing. So they scooped me up, took me back to one of their houses, and by God, they practiced working with others page by page by page. I mean, I would have swore to you today that they must have had it up in front of them, reading it as they talked to me, because I have never seen a truer form of that chapter in action than with those three young men that night. And it changed my life forever, because they started getting me to do a whole bunch of stupid things. They had me driving people around, because apparently a driver's license was like the Holy Grail in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the only thing I didn't have was a little taxi thing to put on the top of my car. But I was driving everybody around. I was pouring coffee. I was shaking hands. I was cleaning bathrooms. I'm still not entirely convinced of the positive motive in the cleaning bathrooms part, but I did it. And what I didn't know is that by doing all these small, seemingly meaningless things, what happened was I started to form deep, heartfelt connections with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when you pour enough cups of coffee, and you shake enough hands, and you clean enough bathrooms, people remember your name. And you will start remembering their name. And whether you like it or not, a relationship forms. And many of the people that I formed relationships with during that period are still here today. And it all started with a handshake, a cup of coffee, and somebody who could not hit the toilet to save their lives. And it's crazy. I mean, it's the smallest things in life and in my sobriety that lead to the biggest benefits. Because that's the biggest thing I have today, is these deep bonds that I have with all of you, with the people in Springfield, the people in all the other places that I've been, all over the world. You know, I'm a high school dropout who got his GED, failed miserably in an attempt at community college, and I have somehow wound up in an amazing career with an amazing opportunity. I travel the world. I fly probably 100,000 miles a year, and I meet people from all different cultures and all different parts of the world, and I get to go to meetings there, and I get to talk to these people, and it's just amazing the closeness and the love I feel regardless of where I go. I don't know where else you get that. I don't know where else where I'd look for that besides in these rooms. And God is always there. God is always a part of that to make all of that happen. And if you need proof, the first time that I ever went out of the country, I was in Prague in the Czech Republic. Beautiful place. But I was in a new relationship. It looked like that relationship was ending. I was probably 3 or 4 years sober. And I was freaking out. I couldn't talk to anybody. I was in a different time zone. None of the people that I usually would talk to when I was going crazy were available. And I was just peeling out of my skin in my hotel room. And we start walking down the streets of Prague with my coworkers to find some place to eat. And I look up, and there's a circle with a triangle hanging over the street. And I promptly said, I gotta go. Have a fantastic evening. Ran down a dark alley. Probably not the first thing you should do when visiting Prague for the first time, but by God, there was an AA symbol and I was going to follow it. Happened to walk into the only English-speaking meeting in Prague, 5 minutes from when it started. And if you don't think that's God yet, as I walk in, holding back tears, crazy as hell, I look across the table at Sam. A man that I shared a service commitment with in St. Louis, Missouri for multiple years, sitting across the tables of Alcoholics Anonymous in Prague. And the moment where all I wanted was a familiar face to cry, to scream, and to get some sanity back. And if that's not God, I don't know what is. I mean, of course he had a reason to be there. God didn't just poof him over there for me. He'd moved over there 9 months prior to start teaching English. But just amazing. Amazing. I'm on the other part of the world. And here's a friendly face. Somebody I know on a first name basis. More impressively, I remember their first name. You know, and the rest of my story, I would say, what I'd want to highlight is just the impact that this program has had on my life since then. Because I was taught to suit up, to show up. And in my experience, if you do the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you follow the steps and you take the suggestions or the requirements or whatever your sponsor chooses to call them, your body will go into AA mode when your mind doesn't know what to do. And thank God I had good sponsorship and good friends that ingrained that in me, because life continues to happen sober. It doesn't get easier. The happiest and saddest moments of my life have taken place in sobriety. You know, and the first test I had was 18 months sober. Got the phone call from my aunt that my grandmother was dying. She said she's got 2 weeks at the most. Now's the time to come if you want to. And thanks to you people teaching me how to be employable, not just employed, but employable, and staying at that place for a length of time, I had just gotten promoted. And I was made a trainer at this call center that I'd been working at for a couple years. And I was supposed to start on Monday. And I called my boss and I said, my grandmother's dying. She has 2 weeks and I need to go up there and be there for my family. And he's a kind man, but he has a business to run. He said, Corbin, I understand. But if you come back, it's probably not going to be to the job that we just gave you. And that's the first time in sobriety, working a program, that I remember having a selfless thought. And I went, thank you so much, sir. I appreciate the opportunity. And I went without hesitation. That was the next right thing in front of me. And I went up there and I didn't make it about me. I sat there and I held my grandma's hand and I talked to her. And everything I talked about was just to show the love and the appreciation that I had for her. And I told her about you people. I told her about the amazing things that AA had been doing in my life. And I just remember her smiling and the tears coming down her eyes. And you can tell I'm already a crier. So at that point, I was already crying. And then my grandpa had to come in and just hammer that into overdrive. Because he said, that's the first time I've seen her smile in weeks. And it was telling her about you people and this program and the difference that it made in my life. And she did pass away just about exactly 2 weeks from when I showed up. And when she passed, I felt a tremendous loss. But every day, I had been going to meetings in Springfield, Illinois. Because that's where they were, right outside Springfield, Illinois. And that AA community showed up at that house every day and took me to a meeting, gave us food, wanted for nothing, and allowed me to be at service. That was the most important part of that entire deal, I will tell you to this day, was being of service during that time of great loss. More important than anything else. First thing my body did when my mind didn't know what to do was it went for a coffee pot, it went for the trash, and it went to shake hands. And I knew that I was at a good home group because there were newcomers fighting me over that coffee pot. And luckily there were some old timers who went, it's okay. He needs it right now more than you do. And I will tell you to this day, there are not many more serene moments than on Wednesday nights like this month when I'm chairing my home group. And I make that walk from the front door with two hands full of trash to the trash can in the back of the lot. The world is never a better place than when I am being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I was able to show my grandma. And that's what I was able to show my family when she died. I got to be there to help them with their chaos, to keep my mom locked in a corner so she stopped terrorizing everybody else. And was just of service. And because of that, I got to play a part in the funeral. I got to have them read the St. Francis prayer at her funeral because that's how I could best describe her to other people. And to know that I got to play a small part in that made a huge deal to me. Fast forward a little bit farther into sobriety. One day I get a call at about 1 a.m. from my dad, which this is never a good call. No one checks their lottery ticket at 1 in the morning, so if you get that call, be prepared. And he said, how long does it take people to detox? That's not a question you want to hear your dad call you about at 1 o'clock in the morning. And my mom was so far gone that she was practically in another universe. And so I had to go meet him. He had to trick her into the hospital, and ultimately she ended up having to be committed. And she said some of the most horrible, nasty, dirty things to me, to my dad, that I've ever heard to this day. Now, I have a program of action. I have a God that loves me and takes care of me no matter what, and I have you people to lean on. My dad didn't have any of that. And I remember watching my dad for the first time in my life come completely unglued. I mean, I felt like I could see into his soul and just see the chaos and the fear and the sadness that he was experiencing. And I remember that as he had to sign the paper to get her committed and they wheeled her off as she was screaming things at him, he fell into my arms and I got to hold him and tell him there was a God that was big enough for the both of us, who was going to take care of us, and that we were going to get through this. And I only knew about that God, and I only knew that was true because of you people. And we get through that. My mom continues to have struggles. She came out of that, tried to be sober for a while, told me she was grateful for me being there, and I told her the same thing. I hugged her, and I held her, and I said, there's a God big enough for the both of us, and he's going to get us through this. And then she tried to commit suicide a couple years later. And I suited up. And I showed up at that hospital with my dad. And I held him. And he said, there's a God big enough for the both of us who's going to get us through this. And that little brother that I treated like an obstacle and an enemy my entire life, he grew up. He grew up to be a fantastic young man with a lot of emotional turmoil. You probably get now why he's in the Marine Reserves. So he calls me one day because one of his friends killed themselves. And keep in mind, this is when he's in high school, 15, 16 years old. He didn't want to talk to his girlfriend. He didn't want to talk to a counselor. He didn't want to talk to his parents. He wanted to talk to his big brother. And that meant so much to me, that my little brother wanted me, wanted to talk and share with me and be vulnerable and be hurt. And a couple weeks later, his friend's little brother killed himself, that my brother was also close with. And as you may have guessed how this ends, he ended up in my arms, crying, and I told him, there is a God big enough for the both of us, and we're going to get through this. And most of the people that I harm the most with my alcoholism and sobriety have been held in my arms as they cried. And I got to tell them what you told me. There is a God. However it may take shape for you, if you can't think of a God, then I would ask you to simply think of a compass. Because that's what I did not have my entire life. That turns out to be what was supposed to be in that hole this entire time, was some type of compass that directed me throughout my life and what I needed to do. So if God's too much to ask for, think of your compass. And you will find that compass in these rooms, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it's a higher power, whatever name you choose to give it, you will find it. And if you don't think you will, I challenge you tonight at 8 o'clock, right after Cliff gets done speaking, because I imagine that's about as packed as this place will be. Maybe don't say the Lord's Prayer out loud, but listen. Listen to the people around you in unison saying that prayer together as a symbol of all of us being connected. And you will feel something. You will get a sense, at the very least, of Alcoholics Anonymous, which in my experience leads you to the higher power. And it will take you to places that you never thought you could go, whether it's a fantastic job that takes you around the world, whether it's to a beautiful woman who you're going to marry, whether it's to having beautiful children and learning how to be a dad for the first time. It still feels weird to say out loud. I've got a beautiful 2.5-year-old baby boy who will never see me drunk, God willing. I've got a beautiful baby girl who's going to be born on November 30th or earlier. She's got her mom's temperament, so she'll probably do whatever she wants. But we decided November 30th, so I'm about to have a little baby girl. And I have a host of friends that I could never replace. The experiences that I've had in this program, I could never begin to pay everything back. And one of the things my sponsors told me is that I will never be able to pay back Alcoholics Anonymous, so the only option is to pay it forward. And so I would ask that if you remember anything from this talk, remember the 30-year-old man who took the moment to go find a young dumb drunk to tell him he loved him, that he was happy to see him, and that he hoped he came back. And in case somehow I've managed to mess up my own story, which I would not put past me, there is something in the book, go figure, that I feel like summarizes my time in sobriety and my time in life better than I can ever put words to. And I'll close with this. And it is a little passage out of one of the personal stories called The Keys to the Kingdom. And it says, "The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness, with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone, and it never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys to the kingdom. And I thank you for having me here."